You're listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Hello, Joe.
Hello, how are you, Mike?
I'm doing well. Hey, Joe, for those that haven't come across you online, introduce yourself to the listeners and tell them why we're talking tonight.
Well, appreciate being on the show, Mike. My name is Joe Baker. I come to you from Little Rock, Arkansas, where I have taught personal finance to the University of Arkansas College of Pharmacy P3 students for the last 21 years.
Whoa.
In doing so, during this past year and a half, I, along with my daughter Lindsay, have written a finance book designed for that age group, and it is called Baker's Dirty Dozen Principles for Financial Independence.
What age group? When you say Lindsay, how old is she?
Lindsay is 33, but the book is really designed for the Gen Y and the millennials, for that age group.
Millennials go through, what, 30-something?
Almost 40.
Wow.
The book is not exclusive to those two generations, especially the stories.
And what's Generation Y?
Generation Y is the one that comes just after the millennials.
After the millennials. So they're...
Early to mid-20s, yes.
Early 20s. Let me ask this, Joe. I'm wondering this theory. Tell me if I'm right or not. That Gen Ys, they're not interested in buying the houses. They're not interested in having the big lawns. And I think part of that is because of maybe a recession or something like that. But they're more interested in experiences of hanging out with their friends and going to the coffee shops and that stuff. And they're not maybe comparing house values, like their house might not be a status symbol and so on. Am I all off on that? Is that just a myth?
No, as a matter of fact, that has bled into the millennials thinking, you know, how people are holding off buying houses. It sounds like I'm kidding about this, but it's like estate sales. You know, you can't sell China anymore because nobody wants to buy it. The younger people don't want to buy. They don't want to inherit anything as far as furniture from their parents or grandparents. There's no sentimentality, it seems. I don't know how to explain that except maybe how you did. It's just like we're more into relationships. And there may not be anything wrong with that.
Yeah, there may not be, except that...
If they don't buy my house when I'm ready to sell it.
Yeah, they better turn around by the time we're ready
right.
to sell stuff. Yeah, but I'm even hearing, like, I got a number of kids, and I'm even hearing, not maybe directly from them, but it's like these people are going out on dates. And, I mean, when I grew up, it was always... I always sprang for things for Margaret, my wife. When the guy went out, I'd always buy the burger or the...
You don't see that now.
The milkshakes, the movies. That's different now. These boys and girls, or young men and young women, they're pulling out their phone and, like, Venmoing each other.
I was just about to tell you that that is what is happening, even on dates.
On dates, yes.
I asked my daughter, I said, why did you Venmo Shane? It wasn't in vogue when I was at dating age. I had to pay for everything.
If I was a thinker, I'd probably say, you know, maybe that's good because... The guys, now this isn't me talking, this is some other movements talking, where maybe the women say, you know, the guys buy all this stuff, and then they expect something of it, favors, let's just put it that way. Now, I don't think that's the case, I just think it's cheap guys who don't have a lot of income for whatever the reason. I don't know. So we were talking a little bit, Joe. So give us a rundown of your book coming out. You had sent it to me and I got through the whole thing, skimmed the whole thing and read some of it. And it's fascinating. It's got really down-to-earth stuff. It's very chunky in terms of there's a lot of info in it. It seems like a lot of cool stories in it. good information. There's one area, though, that I think you might have messed up on. I think you accidentally got my podcast in there, and I don't know how the hell that happened, but...
Well, it was strategic planning that I might get on your show one day. Hey, it didn't use up much typeset.
You'd get out of my show just if you didn't make me pay for my own milkshake and burger if we ever go out. So now that would be the only favor. What's the timing on that? That's coming out soon?
It is. Pre-sale starts November the 1st. The actual book will be published like the 14th of November. So we're right on the cusp of it being published.
Tell our listeners, for all the young punks listening to this, tell them what a baker, because your last name is Baker.
Right.
Tell them what a baker's dozen was.
Well, back in the 14 or 1500s in medieval time, in Europe, if you had a bakery, you know, weights and measures weren't accurate back then.
Hmm.
And if you were a baker and you gave out some bread or rolls or something, and you did not give enough, you could either be fined or flogged. So what the baker would do is just throw in an extra one, which would be a dozen plus one would be 13. This would prevent the baker from getting in trouble with the authorities. So that's how it's come to being. And quite frankly, I just... The little rhyme of it, Baker's Dirty Dozen, I was a fan of the movie. So, well.
It's clever. It's clever. Back in the Baker's Dozen, obviously people could count to 12. Was it just in case you didn't count to 12, or was it more a weight thing?
Exactly. Exactly. Because you could have a small pastry or a large pastry, and it had to be a certain weight.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. And where does a dirty come from in the title?
One of my favorite movies, The Dirty Dozen.
Who was in that?
Oh, that was a classic with Lee Marvin. He takes 13 U.S. prisoners from the military and goes on a secret mission. And whoever survives gets a pardon. And it's Lee Marvin, Ernest Borgnine. And it came out in about like 1970, 71, something like that.
I got to say, because I was born in 66, so I would have been about,
you're just a baby.
I would have been like 5.
Yes.
Now, I remember, Towering Inferno and...
Okay.
With the great actor, Orenthal James Simpson.
Oh, yes. Well, he was, as a matter of fact, he was in The Dirty Dozen.
No way.
Yes. No.
Was he really?
No, I'm telling you, it's Brown. Jim Brown.
Jim Brown.
Yes. Got my running backs mixed up.
Yeah, Jim was a heck of a running back. I saw that Gail Sayers just passed away a couple
weeks ago. Yes, and I had the opportunity to meet him.
You did?
Many years ago. Yes, I did. I even got his business card. I didn't get his autograph because I just think it's kind of silly having someone sign something.
Right.
But he was one of the nicest people of any celebrity I've ever met. He talked to you 101, and he was just, back when I met him about 20 years ago, he was doing some computer software stuff, and I met him at a business function, but he was really, really neat. I even had Mr. Sayers, how much of that Brian song is true? And he laughed. He says, all of it is true. So
for the listeners that don't know, Brian's Song was a movie of Brian Piccolo, Gale Sayers. I think they were rookies on the same year for Chicago, and Piccolo got cancer, and then Sayers came out with, I think it was even labeled I Am Third. It was God, Others, and Then Yourself, something like that, before it was named Brian's Song. But it was sad all the way around.
It's a tearjerker, but it's very uplifting tearjerker.
Sayers, he had just a different stride, and so fluid, I think the word is.
Oh, he was so fluid, yes.
Baker's Dirty Dozen. The title sort of gives it away. There's 13 summary lessons of financial principles and so on. Principles that stand the test of time, but you come at it from especially the angle of teaching pharmacy all this time.
I had really two goals for this, and I'm sure both of them are self-serving, but so be it. The first was the macro goal, is to get as much information out there about financial, I'll call it financial literacy, as much as possible, because there are just so many people, and we're talking about pharmacists, doctors, lawyers, have high IQs, but they don't know anything about finances. It's just, it's really, really incredible. And so I wanted, that was my goal, is to reach as many people as I could. And the micro was selfish as well. Having two daughters that were liberal arts majors and a son-in-law who's a liberal arts major. And I noticed your background, he's very similar to your track. He's working on his dissertation in theology right now. So since they were all liberal arts majors, they weren't exposed to money that much. And I said, you know, if I could get my daughters and son-in-law to help edit this book, hey, I might not have them depend on me later on. So, and it's, if I could just kind of detour a little bit, it has really worked, because we were playing cards at our house this summer. And we, every Friday night, we have a bunch of friends over. I say a bunch, about six or eight. And it just so happened my daughter and her son and my son-in-law were there. And one of the players, the card players, he's a lawyer. And we were talking about, you know, finances a little bit. He said, well, I couldn't tell you the difference between an IRA and a Roth IRA. And just on cue, my son-in-law to the right of me starts explaining in detail all the tax consequences and why it's a good thing if the tax rates are up when you pull it out. I turned to him and I said, how did you know that? He said, from your book that I edited. I said, it worked.
That's good. Now, I know from reading through the book that you were not playing poker, probably.
No, it's we call it oh heck. If you're up north, it would be called something else. But we're in the South, and we're very Bible Beltish.
We're cussers. Yeah, I don't like. I hate all board games. You know, I realized that they call board games because the word board is in them. And then I realized that they make plastic coated cards in case I get so sick of playing that I barf on them and they can clean them up.
Well, this has stood the test of time as far as our little group. Yeah. And it's cheap entertainment. A deck of cards and a margarita will cure just about anything.
Years ago, without my kids find it hard to believe that, I say, guys, we had Rudolph. Rudolph was on once a year on CBS at 8 o'clock on, you know, December 19th. Mm-hmm. And if you missed it, you missed it, you know.
Exactly.
And when you tell the millennials and the Gen Ys and you say, we didn't have VCRs, we didn't have computers, you didn't have, I guess you had records and things like that. But it was certainly a nice way to get together with people. It was cheap. It was fun. And it was a decent way to go. Joe, my upbringing was, my dad was a business owner and he owned the pharmacy. And he didn't really preach business and money matters to us, but he would always share things as they came up. One thing I never understood from my dad, he's like, Mike, how much money do you have? I'm like, you know, as an 8-year-old, I'm like, well, Dad, I got, you know, $20. And we'd be going into Cedar Point, you know, or an amusement park. And he'd said, well, why don't you let me have that? Because if you lose it, you've lost your money. If I lose it, I've lost my money. Now, what he meant there, he was trying to be very loving, fatherly about it, saying that if I lose it, I'll pay you back, you know, kind of thing. That's the one thing I never understand. I'm like, I didn't cuss like this as an 8-year-old, but I'm like, what? But now I'm thinking, I was like, what the hell did he mean that it's his money if he loses it? Well, he was just being nice about it. So for me, it's foreign for me that this wouldn't be as basic as you know, the back of your hand. But you had mentioned that you were talking about it to your daughter, who's 33, and she was maybe doing some proofing for you, but she was coming across concepts that were kind of foreign to her, right?
Yeah, exactly. I actually started writing the book on August the 15th of last year. And I was whizzing through it. I was, tell you what, lightning speed. Mainly it was, maybe I shouldn't tell this story, but I will anyway. My wife was in and out of the hospital during all that time. I mean, she's okay now, but she spent a lot of time in the hospital. And, you know, it's tough writing a book in the hospital, but especially when your wife is over there moaning in pain and I have to go to get the nurses to bring some pain pills in here and say, hey, I'm trying to write a book. Can we get some pain pills in here?
And you can only say shut up to her so many times before people think you're starting to be a little bit rude to her.
Yeah, and when she brings up that, I say, honey, I think you were just hallucinating back then. So, but fast forward, I thought I had finished just about all the book in during the Christmas break in January of this year. So my liberal arts daughter, Lindsay, she said, well, let me read it.
Joe, let me back up just a second.
Okay.
Part of the reason you were whizzing through this is you've probably at one point have talked through all these the stories that are yours, you've probably talked through all of these in your class over the years, right?
Yes, yes.
And how many years was that?
Well, I've taught at University of Arkansas College of Pharmacy for 21 years. Most of them are both semesters.
Finance,
personal finance for the P3s.
I mean, you're basically like a tuned in, well, let's say a comedian will do this or, you know, stage actor will, they'll have this timing down. They know what's going to hit and when it's going to hit and when the students are sleeping or when they stay awake and things. So you could really be writing this from all that experience and making it pretty damn interesting because you've already tested it on a crowd for 20 years.
Yes, but unfortunately, I had a lot of technical information in there as well. And Lindsay, she'd come across something that, what opportunity cost? What does that mean? I said, well, it's right there in black and white. She says, I don't know what that means. And I said, well, you don't understand. This book is designed for your age group. You've got to know. And she said, well, I don't understand it. So, we would hash it out. I would explain it to her. Then she'd explain it back to me. And once she explained it back to me correctly, she rewrote it. I would say we went paragraph by paragraph for two solid weeks during the spring, during the Christmas break. And she edited, so she threw out a bunch of my good stories too, because she thought they were, well, quite frankly, politically incorrect, but they were funny anyway. One time she fell down in the floor and said, Dad, she was just dying laughing. Said, Dad, you cannot tell this story.
Now, come on. You've got me excited. Now, tone it down. But remember, our listeners are grown adults here. So give me a little example here.
I will tell you the story, but I'm just going to tell you right now that it's not in the book.
All right. So because she yanked it.
Yes, she did.
All right.
This is typical. And I don't think it's, you know, the ends justify the means because it's funny. A buddy of mine grew up with, he is right now 67 years old. About 5 years ago, he decided he wanted a bride to help him raise his other kids from his first marriage. So he goes shopping online and gets a Filipino bride. And he gets her home, and she's as cute as she could be, great wife, just wonderful. And evidently they're a little fiery, and knowing and also she's 20 years younger than he is, so he got her a little upset. So she pulls out a machete and chases him around the house, and he's telling me the story, and I said, Robbie, I said, that is awful dangerous. He says, but you don't understand, she's sweet 85% of the time. Now, was it that bad?
No.
And he couldn't send her back because he lost the mail order receipt.
Now that's not true, right? That's a made-up
story. That is a true story.
Those are true stories.
That is a true story.
Now, wait a minute. You told me that when we were talking before, you told me you've got a ton of stories from other
Yes, I do.
People in here. Is it actually written in their hand, or did they tell it to you and you're then putting it into your prose?
I solicited from all around. I said, if you'd like to have your financial story considered, please send it to me. And the only thing we did was Lindsay edited it because, you know, a lot of people can't write as well. But there it is in their words.
Really?
Yes. And there are some, there's some that will make you cringe, but it all falls into a purpose to help back up something else. Like if you're, you know, the vices of gambling and, you know, stories like that.
The things that Lindsay did, besides cleaning things up a little bit, and I don't mean the editing, I mean the stories.
Yes.
What were you doing? What did she catch? What was the error of your ways for that group? And how did you miss it? Why were you missing it?
You know, I don't know if it's a generational thing or just something with me. As you know, there's just some people that are creative writers.
Mm-hmm.
And both my daughters, their writing skills are just unreal. I would, you know, I've read this book 1,000 times. And one day I was in the dining room and I said, wow, this is, I don't remember writing this. And Lindsay says, you didn't. I added that. And I said, well, shoot, I thought it sounded pretty good there. I mean, it's just subtle things in how they're using certain words or phrases. It's really remarkable.
So basically the same gist of the paragraph even, but they would just spice up the words a little bit or something.
If you had mine next to Lindsay's, there's just no comparison.
Really?
Yes.
There sure are some gifts that people have that you don't even know that they're there. Because I'm sure you thought yourself a good writer and teacher and so on.
Well, I thought I was a good storyteller until she yanked those stories out. Thanks a lot, Lindsay. My next book is going to be The Unabridged Storytelling by Joe Baker.
And you're still teaching.
I'm still teaching. And I'm not going to run for office, so I don't care. So
it used to be like, hey, I got this good story. Now you're going to get up there and say, I'm not sure if you guys are going to like this. And then you're going to tell the same story. You
know? It's funny how you should mention that because during both semesters while I was writing this book, I'd test the story. And they say, we're agreeing with Lindsay. That should not be in there. Of course, they'd laugh, but...
Joe, with your daughters going to liberal arts schools, was there anything there that they, like, disagreed on the stance of being a different political persuasion or a different, well, this is against women, Dad, you can't do this, or this is racist, you can't do this. Were there any of those things that you, and I'm not saying they were bad or good, but, and we don't want to get into the details because we're not saying who's right or wrong, but were there any that they said, this is sensitive, Dad, you can't do this?
Well, it's funny you should mention that. A perfect example of that is from my Principle 13, make a difference in your family, community, and place of worship. Before I had, family, community, and church. And one of my daughters says, you know, you got to be more inclusive. It's like place of worship because you have mosque and temples and that. And it, just little things like that that my generation, we just don't even think of. But they were really pushed the social, it's called the social governance and environmental aspect of investing. They like that. And we have a special section that's my daughter's choice. They like the investing in companies like BlackRock that have socially conscious in their investments.
There's probably a lot of those that are probably decent. I don't like to agree with any of them because I don't like to give an inch on many things to my daughters.
Well, my book would have been pretty short if that had been...
So, in other words, you had to give the inch or they would have pulled everything out of it?
Yes.
I got like two daughters that are vegan, and they're vegan for moral reasons, not just for, well, moral in the terms of the environment, you know, not like God doesn't want this, but more moral in terms of the environment. So I came down one breakfast and I said to my daughter, I said, look, I'm eating cage-free eggs. And I know they're eggs still, but, and I'm not a vegan, but I'm eating cage-free eggs. she said, well, Dad, they still cut the beaks off of those so they don't do this and this and this. And I said, well, they might be beakless, but they're not in a cage, you know, so I'm trying to save myself here, you know. And she said, it's still just as bad and this and this and this. So I thought it was the appropriate time to pull out my ace in the hole. And I came in with, well, Grace. Oh, I shouldn't have said her name. I came into my daughter. I said, well, Jesus ate fish. Well, then she came back with, well, then Jesus was wrong.
Oh, boy.
So then I come in with my over-the-top.
Mm-hmm. The dad thing.
The over-the-top, pretend like I'm really offended and like Jesus needs me to stick up for him. You know, right. I come to my daughter and say, well, no, how, you know, this and that. Well, then she kind of runs out or doesn't want to talk about it anymore. And so as she's going up the stairs, I'm yelling up the stairs. I'm like, well, I didn't bring up the beakless chickens. You did. And my wife's yelling at me to calm down because it's only 7 in the morning and stuff like that. But I think if I wrote a book, I think I would have a front cover and an end cover and nothing in between if my daughters edited it.
Well, fortunately, some of the numbers stayed in because they're universally accepted. But
yeah, the numbers have to stay.
That's right.
Let's say that you had a editor on your back, mm-hmm. you know, someone really pushing you. What have you learned from this experience? If you had to write another book, what would you have done differently? A different order? Would you have outlined it differently? Would you have got someone involved earlier? What would make it simpler next time?
Well, I love stories. I would love to have more stories. Of course, you know, I think there are not counting my stories, but from contributors, about 35 stories. So that's just from, but I filled it with a lot of my stories as well. And that would be probably the only thing. I got to admit, once Lindsay and Brooke and her husband Gabe got involved, it just it went really, really well. I didn't get to chance tell all my stories, but hey, that's okay because it is very inclusive and there's nothing in there that I think could offend anybody. But. I'm real pleased with it, so I doubt if I'd ever do another book because this was something else.
It's hard.
It is, and I heard you on one podcast once telling somebody. You said, "Well, why don't you write a book?" You were telling your guest.
Yeah,
and she said, "Oh, we thought about that." And then you added, "says you know, it gives a defining moment in your life."
Yeah,
and that's the way I've looked at this. As you know, you don't make any money off of books.
No, no, no.
Your book usually it funnels to a YouTube channel or a podcast, and I'm not doing any of that. I worked hard to keep this book under $20 because I just think a paperback over $20 is just non-existent, which cuts into some money, but not making much. I just want to get it in as many young people's hands as possible, and I accepted no money. You know, I mentioned Vanguard in the book and some other companies, Investopedia, and I took no money from anybody. So I'm pure as a driven snow, financially speaking, of course. But
pure as snow or something.
That's a Southern term, pure as a driven snow, even though we don't have snow.
Books are tough. This might have been the episode you're referring to, but a few years ago, I wrote 100 blog posts, and it happens to be that about 50 were business and 50 were kind of family. So I split them up into two books, mm-hmm. put them on Amazon, and I think one of the hardest things to do, there are probably 99 people around who say they're working on a book compared to the person that says they've finished it. And I did that with a musical album I made 25 years ago. Just it's got a fan base of one. That's just me. And these couple books I wrote, there's just something really difficult but really satisfying about finishing something.
Yes. Exactly.
And it's hard to finish something. Well, you know this, Joe. When you think you're 5% away from being done, you're about halfway done.
Sure.
Wouldn't you say?
I mean, up until the typeset was done, they kept saying, this is the deadline, this is the deadline. I'd keep sending something else because you may be in the shower or driving and you think of something, says, you know, that would be really good in there. And but there has to be a deadline. And
yeah, there has to be a deadline, but you can.
But you're satisfied with when it's finished. And I'll be even more excited when I actually have one in my hand.
Oh, that's a time when you get one in your hand and you.
Yes.
And then you got to smell it. And then, and then Joe, you got to. Got to kick your wife out of bed that night because you're going to sleep with it right on your pillow.
That would be between the covers, right? The book.
Yeah, there you go. It's a comedy book. Years ago, I stopped selling contraceptives in my pharmacy about 20 years ago. And I wrote a book on the story of that. And it was a lot about my dad and my relationship emotionally. Who was the emotional leader? Who was the emotional child? Did that ever switch? You know, how did all that come together? And I had this book written for probably 5 years. And during that time, my faith would, what's the best way to put it? My faith would change where I might not describe something the same way now as I did 10 years ago. You know, for example, 10 years ago, I might have said, I felt like God was blah, blah, blah. And now I might say, sometimes I don't know my, what's the phrase, my head from a hole in the ground? So, I forget what that phrase is.
You're close, but that was taken out of my book too, so.
So I might have said it that way back then, but now I might say, you know, half the time I'm screwed up, my thoughts go in and out, I have no idea where this thought's coming from. Maybe it's coming from God, maybe God's telling me this, maybe it's coming from selfishness, maybe it's coming from fear, I don't know. But for some reason, at that time, I felt I had to do this. Now, that's a hell of a lot different from saying, I feel God was telling me this, you know?
Right.
But I got advice and they just said, you've got to write the book from basically where you are at that time. Mm-hmm. And that's what books do. They capture, they have a front and a back cover and they capture things. They force you to go down and later you can do something else if you want to switch your thoughts around. But that's an interesting thing about a book because it captures your thought. At that time, I mean, my thoughts in that book are basically as a 25-year-old or, you know, a 30-year-old. And so are the words to my songs that I did. So no more books left in you, Joe.
No, this is it.
Are you sure?
If I were ever to do another book, it'd be a short one on networking because I think the kids are missing out on some good networking opportunities today. Because we're in a social media type where face-to-face and, you know, all of that. I do touch on that a little bit in the book, but it's more on a financial nature. But networking will actually be good in finances, too.
Would you include the social media in computers and things, or would you try to stay away from it?
I think you would have to. I think the jury is still out on, you know. Before COVID, I walked in a restaurant one time and was sitting there and looked over and these four college girls were not even conversing. They were all on their devices. And I did make a comment. I said, you know, when I left, I didn't want to be stoned while I was there. But I said, when I left, I said, it's none of my business, but you know, you guys are here together. You nearly need to share the time together. And then I'm sure they said something bad after I left, but oh well.
You bet you were hightailing it out of there.
I was. I was just, I was in the running mode, ready to go. And they were probably texting each other, saying, who was that old fool?
You know, I did a blog post on that one time, though, and it is the common thought that everybody's doing that. But I remember a couple things. Like, in fact, Joe, that's how I run these podcasts. I always pretend like the person I'm riding with up to my cottage, which was my dad's cottage, a couple hours up north.
Right.
When I'm in the car riding up there, I never say I have to cover everything we need to know about something. It's like,
right,
what's coming up at the moment that we want to talk about? There's two devil's advocate I'll play to the people sitting around texting, because I don't necessarily disagree with you, but I've got this picture of my dad up in the cottage way before social media, and we didn't have a TV. And because TV, you can make maybe the same argument that everybody was glued on the TV. Everybody's glued to the TV. No one's talking to each other. So we were up there at the cottage, no TV, no social media. And I got this picture of my dad reading. You know, my dad was like 55 or my age at the time.
Yes.
And, you know, cottage magazines are like 4 years old, you know, and nobody throws them out and they just stay up there, you know. But my dad was reading like, I have a picture of him reading like Cosmopolitan or something like that, or Red Book, you know, because you run out of stuff to read. So it wasn't like we were all sitting around and singing songs. Everybody still had their nose in maybe a three-year-old magazine, because people are people. So sometimes, like my family, we'll be sitting around by the fireplace and there, the TV's not on and we're all looking at our phones. But sometimes there's still interesting conversations going on, you know, hey, did you hear this? Did you do that? And you can talk because nobody's saying, you know, shut up, I got to catch the end of this show or something like that. But,
and that's why we like our card game, is because it,
yes,
you can have conversations while you're playing cards. Like, I don't know the difference between an IRA and a Roth IRA, but I don't think there's going to be book two. It's, as you know, it takes a lot of energy to write a book.
It's a lot of energy.
A lot of, when we, Lindsay said, I don't understand how you're using, what citation protocol are you using? I said, what are you talking about? She says, well, you just can't just put down somebody else's words. You've got to cite it and then either change it up or, you know, have all these symbols or something boxed in. And she teaches at a private school here, eighth grade, is social studies / geography, but she teaches citations like in writing and, you know, bibliographies and all that to the eighth graders.
I hope you told her, well, you'd do it if you think you're so smart.
She did do it.
I saw like you had a list in there by Rachel Cruz, you know, four or five points about something.
Yes.
That's what she's talking about, right? You've got to notate all that stuff and put all that in there.
I think there are about 111 citations.
Is there really?
Something along that line. Yes. You think all this is mind knowledge? Heck no.
There's two different kinds of books. There's like books like I wrote where I quoted my grandma and my 8-year-old friend and things like that. But then there's real books like yours. And I think at some point, that's a real big feather in the cap for that kind of book, of having all those citations and stuff.
Well, it was an awakening on all the rules involved. And fortunately, I had a daughter that knew about those, and she was able to go through it and make sure that everything was done right. And plus, we had a copy editor, too, but there's no doubt in my mind she cleaned up so much before we went to the true copy editor.
What does your other daughter do with the liberal arts?
She was teaching in New Jersey while her husband, my son-in-law, was at Drew University working on his PhD. Then she just, a few months ago, she's there now, but this summer she got accepted into UCLA program for doctoral. And the area of study, I kid you not, is Near Eastern Languages and Cultures. That's a really study. But, she speaks some Syriac, Arabic, Spanish. She was a Spanish major in undergraduate. So she has that brain that you just pick up languages like crazy. And so she'll either teach or work for the CIA one day, I guess. But who knows? But they're both in Los Angeles now, and he's working on his dissertation for his PhD, and she is in classes now, virtually, of course, for her PhD.
What is he studying?
It's along the lines of ethics and theology, and I forgot his... I would tell you his dissertation, but it's so long and
detailed,
convoluted.
Yeah. Very specific, right?
Yes, it is. But it's mostly in the area of Christian ethics and theology, philosophy.
Oh, geez, philosophy. Don't get me going. I was down in the seminary for a year thinking I was going to – I needed to try the priesthood. I needed to leave 500 miles away to give it a shot, get away from my family. Wasn't really for me. We'd have these philosophy classes, and I'd just come in and back, you know, and just sit there. But all these guys, they'd all sit up front, and the teacher would say something. I'd have no freaking idea what he said. And then one of the students would say something, and then they'd all get a good chuckle, and I had no clue what was going on. So I knew that wasn't my thing. Where did you end up teaching this class? I mean, how did you go from your degree in what?
Majored in marketing, because in my undergraduate, this sounds terrible, especially that I'm dealing in numbers now. At my university where I went, there were two majors that you could major in and not have to take college algebra. It was pre-law and marketing, business marketing. But pre-law, you had to have a foreign language. I said, well, I guess I'll be a marketing major then. And ended up marrying a math teacher on top of that. But I majored in marketing, and I did teach high school marketing for about four years. And I'd still be in that secondary arena if it weren't for a friend of mine who ran for Congress. And he asked me to work in his congressional campaign and with the thoughts of going to D.C. and all that sort of thing. And he lost 2 percentage points in runoff. So then I had to get a real job and got into insurance and with pharmacist mutual companies. I served 28 years to the day with them and retired early last year. I always like to say I retired early. And back in the 90s, I was always at the College of Pharmacy, and that's, you know, I talked to them about maybe doing a class. Basically, I knew just about everybody at the college, most of the pharmacists in the state, so I wasn't least a foreign person. And I'd hear these stories about the students. This back in the 90s, where they'd get out making $50,000 a year, which was more than, you know, 95% of the Arkansans, and they were going broke. And I said, what about a little finance course? Talk about student loans and some of the other things. And it just kind of morphed into an actual class. And I will say this. I'm not bragging on me, but it is the most important. I mean, not the most important. It's the most desired elective at the University of Arkansas College of Pharmacy. But it's because of the content. You know, I'm not an eloquent speaker, but I tell them the first day of class, I say, listen, if you just pay attention, we're not going to worry about grades, but if you miss a class, it could be $1 million decision. There may be something I say during that time that'd be worth $1 million. And I would also say, just trust me. My goal is that you'll never sit in the back of this class and say, when am I ever going to use that? That is my goal, because we've all been there. And I say, I'm just going to tell you exactly what you really need to know and nothing more.
You know, Joe, you made that into a black and white issue between being a good teacher or good content, but you forgot about the good looks.
If you say so. I'm married.
Well, all right. Let's throw that out. That's not an option anymore then.
But I will tell you this. I don't look at the students the same anymore, because about 10 years in, I was doing the first day of class, and I had a student came up and says, Mr. Joe, I think you used to date my mother-in-law in college. And I said, you know, you're not starting off this class
very
well.
No, that's not a very good way to start.
So
the pharmacist mutual, you're associating with a lot of pharmacists. That got you probably physically around the school. Sometimes you were meeting someone there or something.
Well, it did, because the students had the student liability policy.
Oh.
So I would be there at registration.
Gotcha.
Each year.
Gotcha.
And I can remember it was probably in 98 because I started class in 99 that I was sitting here with the dean and the assistant dean, and we were just talking about money and students struggling after they get out. And I said, well, you know, if they're making this much money, why are they struggling? And it comes down to choices. And I said, well, maybe we could do a class, because I was working on my MBA at the time with the idea of maybe teaching on the undergraduate level, the graduate level, because I love teaching. Not because I'm necessarily good at it, but it is just, you just get that feedback. The students are like sponges. They'll just soak it in and participate. And, you know, you get some classes that are not as much as others, but you think you're not reaching them. Then during the break or after class or before class, they come up with 1,000 questions and all that. It's just been just a thrill.
Did you need a teaching certificate for high school?
Yes. That was kind of an interesting, because I had a business degree. But I had a mentor, a marketing professor. He's the one that called me about a teaching position in South Arkansas. And he said, you'll have to have a teaching certificate, but here's what we'll do. We'll get you a provisionary. And in the college that I went to, Southern Arkansas University in Magnolia, they were so student oriented and still are. But they said, we will get you the necessary hours to get certified. And even this instructor, he manuscripted a couple of courses for me in the marketing education department. He says, we'll get with the education department at Southern Arkansas University, and we will get you certified. And it took a couple of years, but I did.
To teach in the college, you probably even needed less, right? You just maybe needed a college degree to teach?
No, colleges want you to have at least a master's.
Gotcha.
In the subject area.
When you mentioned MBA, was that something you were able to complete?
Yes. Coincidentally, I completed it in 99, which was the same year I started teaching.
Well, was that coincidental, or did that open the door for you?
I think it opened the door for me, because the year prior, I was working on the classes, and I said, you know, I will have a degree. Now, they might have allowed me to teach without it, but I suspect not.
Yeah.
You know how academia is. They like those little letters past it. You know, and they call me Dr. Baker, and I say, listen, I don't have a PhD. I'm like Howard Wolowitz on the Big Bang Theory. I only have a master's.
Yeah. I'm all for people being called doctor and so on, but I talked to my kids about that. They said, Dad, if you were a doctor, would you want to be called doctor? I said, sure, during my day. But I said, I'm not so sure. Let's say I'm a heart surgeon. I'm not so sure on a weekend when I'm watching football with my family that I want to be reminded of who I am because of school. In other words,
right.
Let's say at the pharmacy, I'm known as a business owner. I don't want someone to come up to me on a Sunday when I'm watching a game or something and say, Mr. Business Owner. It's like, well, yeah, but that's tomorrow morning. But I don't know.
Right.
Everybody's worked their tails off to get any kind of a doctorate degree. So I don't take anything away from that.
Right.
Just because I'm not that. I'm not bitter or anything.
Of course not. And my students, you know, some of them, they have a hard time. I tell them I want me to call me Joe. And if they just can't do that, I say, just call me Mr. Joe.
Mr.
And
Joe.
Because I've never even today, I still have the Peter Pan principle. My dad, I wish I had a dollar for every time he says, when are you going to grow up? I said, Dad, I hope I never grow up.
Yeah.
That's why I see humor in everything. And that, it, you know, that's why I like to tell funny stories. And, you know, even my mom, who was on her deathbed in Shreveport, Louisiana in 2009, my sisters and I were sitting around her, and we were telling stories, and there was so much laughter in the ICU unit. I think they thought we were nutty. But, you know, that was just a part of it. And I try to find humor in just about everything. It just makes me feel good, and hopefully it makes others feel good too.
Some of my older sons, somewhere they got this phrase that says, if you can't joke about everything, you can't joke about anything. I don't know where the hell they got that from. Now my wife gets mad at me for overstepping some boundary. I just quote that. I don't know. I'm just quoting my son. He might have made it up, you know. I don't know. So tell me about our friends at Your Financial Pharmacists.
Yes, they have been great, involved. As a matter of fact, Tim Ulbrich was the catalyst. He approached me in about May of last year and said, hey, have you thought about turning your Baker's Dirty Dozen into a book?
Because Tim had had you in college, or?
No. Tim, it's kind of interesting. Tim and Your Financial Pharmacist, he's located in Ohio, and they came out with Seven-Figure Pharmacist. And I said, finally, I have a textbook I can use in classes designed for pharmacists. And I said, now I don't have to write a book.
Yeah.
So anyway, and I used it in class and started sending them some success stories, and some of my students who got out, one in particular, they paid off like $212,000 in 4 years of student loans. And he, and several of my students have been on his podcast for, and so May of last year, he says, hey, have you thought about turning that into a book? And I said, well, I don't know. Then the more I thought about it, I said, you know, a lot of former students have told me I should make my class into a book. And I said, well, I might do it, but I don't want to write just your same old finance book, because they can be as boring as they can be. And I bring nothing new to the table. It's all about investing early and, you know, the mutual funds. It's just your basic things. But I solicited, I think, funny and interesting stories from people. And I have some stories, and I just wanted to package it a way that the younger generation can read it and say, this is pretty neat. This is pretty neat. And that's what I was going for. I wanted to be something different, something that they could say, you know, I was just reading it. I thought for the finances, and it comes up with all these stories in there. So basically, Your Financial Pharmacist pretty much bankrolled everything. They have, Tim has just spent so much time helping with the editing process. His feedback has been invaluable. You know, there are three Tims over there: Tim Baker, Tim Ulbrich, and Tim Church. But Tim Ulbrich's the one I've been dealing with, and they have paid for the copy editing. And my only cost is I've got a P3 student that is helping on the promotions, and he is just a whiz at all this stuff and social media. And I'm having him do something. We just did a skit for Halloween, so you'll have to check that out.
My goal on this podcast, it really took some time to think it through. And my goal ended up being, like I said about the driving, is I wanted to do something that was interesting to me and entertaining to me. And some of the stories that come out of it, I suppose, are valuable. And once in a while, someone will write to me and say, you know, I learned a lot from you. And I'm like, well, you must have been listening to another podcast. But
you never know who you reach.
Well, you don't know who you reach. And a lot of the things that are very common to me, like we talked about, you know, from my dad or from your dad and things like that, you don't even know the story has any value to it. But sometimes just mentioning one thing about whatever, you know, answering the phone a certain way or whatever, you know, you don't know what's going to hit some people. And sometimes it does. So I got two books out of you now. Now, I'm not saying we're going to write a third book. But
a third book.
I know. But I just want to dig one more time, not book wise. I want to dig at least one more time. What else do you think, if anything, do you have to offer that could maybe be some kind of a book? So we talked about finance. We talked about, you know, networking. What else do you think you have?
Well, just off the top of the head, it would be my principle 13, giving back. Because, you know, I don't know if you ever watched the House MD, the old TV show.
Yeah, with the Australian guy, but has the U.S. accent. Yes. Yeah.
And he made a comment on several occasions, says, no one ever does anything for anybody else or gives away anything except for selfish reasons. And I said, well, that may be true. It could be true, but why can't it be a win-win? Why can't I teach or give away some knowledge and help somebody else out? It helps me, but it'll help them as well. And if you could focus more on giving away things, the nice thing about my principles, I end up with making you wealthy in your heart, body, and soul. And really, that's what it's really about, is to help other people. And at least in my aspect of it. And it's, yeah, I know a little bit about your background. It has almost an evangelical feel to it, because we're spreading the message of financial literacy. You don't know who it's going to attach hold to, and you feel good about it.
We can use any gifts that we have to maybe make things just a little bit smoother for people, in order to give them maybe a little more security or something like that. And we didn't even know we're doing it, I suppose.
Yeah. And I want to make it clear, I'm not promoting prosperity ministry either, you know, theology. I'm just talking about being blessed by having achieved some financial success and giving back.
A lot of times it's just giving people a target of just even being organized or even knowing what the hell you're supposed to be doing. Do you find that pharmacists in particular coming out of school might make unique mistakes that, let's say, I don't know, someone else coming out might make, a marketer or someone who's, you know, in a chemical engineer or whatever? Did you feel pharmacists might make any in particular mistakes? And maybe some of that's because of the nature of what kind of people maybe go into pharmacy?
Well, one of the things that I have noticed through the years is they come out making six figures and more than their parents ever dreamed about making, and they have made some unwise choices at the very beginning. I had a student this last semester said he was going to buy a Corvette as soon as he gets out of school. And I said, how much do you have in student loans? This is one-on-one. And he said, $200,000. I said, why don't we just wait on that Corvette for a little bit and work on that student loans? Because it's something called lifestyle creep, where you feel like you deserve it. You know, I worked my tail off for 6-7 years and I deserve this. Well, that's fine. I'm not telling anybody they can't buy anything or not do anything. I just want everyone to know the opportunity costs for every economic decision they make. And it kind of drives them crazy sometimes when I point that out. But to answer your question, I don't know that the only thing that would be different is they make more than any other graduate at that age.
One thing I've always kind of thought about pharmacists, to their credit, is maybe it's because I work in a neighborhood that's not above middle class, and my, you know, employees are middle class and so on. And I know in your book you talked about, you know, you don't want to show up to negotiate in a Cadillac, you know.
Right.
And it always seemed like people who were, let's say, physicians or attorneys had a little bit more keeping up with the Joneses to do. I have a theory on that. As a business owner, that's kind of because we all have, I'm not going to put you in my category, but we all have pride, and we like to, deep down, you like to maybe show your stature a little bit. But I've always thought that my stature is kind of in the pharmacy, where I can drive by and say, that's my building, that's my store, that's what I'm known for. Therefore, I don't have to be known for my car. I don't have to be known for my watch and jewelry and things like that. But I always had this idea that because attorneys and physicians, especially working in a hospital or in a big firm, because they don't have something that they can point to, you know, they can't say that's my hospital or that's my thing, that they tend to point to other stuff that might have more, it might be more visual because they don't have a building to point to. That's just a theory of mine. Now, you can put that in your fourth book if you want to.
I'll have a whole library in my house to add on. I am amazed at how many people, like on our street and several other streets that we live in a kind of affluent area, how many that are 30-something years old. And statistically speaking, these people don't make enough to have these houses. And it's just, I just wonder what is going on. But as far as the psychology of it, that's a possible. But do pharmacists that work in hospitals, do they think
yeah,
the way
that's true.
Do they think the
yeah.
way the doctors do?
Yeah, that's true. I don't know. That's a good question. We'll have to look and see if they have diamonds on the soles of their shoes or something. So, Joe, the book's coming out, and when can they...
They can actually pre-order right now, and if they order, go to bakersdirtydozen.com, the website. It'll redirect you to your financial pharmacist. The book is $19.95. However, if you put in the coupon code BAKER, they get 15% off up until November the 7th. So it'll be 15% off of the 19.5. That's a pre-sale. And then the card won't be charged until, I think, November the 19th. And then that's when the books are coming out, mid-November.
Well, Joe, golly, what a pleasure to meet you. That was a lot of fun talking. And I'm glad that we got to go beyond the covers of the book and have some fun with this. And I'm encouraging everybody to pick up a copy of this because there's more stories where these came from, even though your daughter has watered them down.
Or taken them out.
She wouldn't even water them down. Those must have been horrendous stories that they just got yanked.
Yes, but they're so funny.
I know.
Oh.
I had that with a podcast just this last week. There was two things that we said that didn't fit. It didn't come out right. Probably not being politically correct in them. And they were funny, and I had to cut them out, and it just killed me to cut them. But I thought, better not.
We're just in a too sensitive society today.
I know.
But, oh well. Well, just think what life would be like if we didn't laugh.
Who am I kidding? I don't study. I've heard it somewhere that, you know, the court jester back in the day, you know, he was the only one that could tell the truth. To the mm-hmm. king, you know, he was the only, he could tell absolute truths and everybody would just get a hoot out of it because they knew that, well, he was the only one allowed to do it. And so that's the thing about comedians now too. It's like some of these guys have been on YouTube and then the minute they get signed up by some other, you know, Netflix or something like that, they're out there apologizing and watering it down and things like that. And that's when truths start to get hidden, you know, when the comedians can't do that. So I'll still be looking for those excerpts, Joe, from your book.
Well, you heard one story that was taken out. So
we're not going to let your daughter do that to the rest of us. She might make a better book, but we all deserve to hear Joe's stories.
You ought to hear, as Paul Harvey said, the rest of the story.
We need that. We're going to have a secret site, maybe on the dark web. I don't think it's dark web material, though.
Oh, no.
Just a little fun.
It would just, my viability as a candidate for a political office would be in jeopardy, but that's about it.
I think to myself, some of the things I text my friend, you know, I'll see something on Mail Online or, you know, or something, and I'll text him and it'll be off color, you know. But I'm like, well, there's one less state. Thankfully, I'm past a political career.
Oh, yeah. Another 30 years, you could run for president.
Once I get old enough, I only need about another 20 years or so, and then I'll be primed for that.
Yeah, you would.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know how we've gotten to that.
I don't even know how they, the stamina, it's tough. I worked in a campaign when I was in my 20s, a congressional campaign, and we went from sun up to sundown past that, and it was grueling.
Joe, I don't know how the hell they do it. I typically only schedule one, no more than two of these recordings a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I only need one a week on average.
Right.
But after two, I mean, what, 3 hours a week of talking? And these guys are going for, you know, 15 hours a day?
Oh, I know.
And they're 70, 80? You know, I mean, it's just crazy.
It is.
It's a certain gift they have for sure, anybody doing that. So, all right, Joe, we'll be watching.
Hey, appreciate it, and thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Business of Pharmacy podcast with me, your host, Mike Kelzer. Please subscribe for all future episodes.